Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard across the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today, after charged and at times contentious hearings over sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, we hear how Utah's senators, both members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, are reacting. Also, the timely visit to Utah of Anita Hill, who 27 years ago testified in hearings remarkably similar to yesterday's. Plus, the LDS Church and legislative leaders are working on medical marijuana legislation. So what does that mean for the proposition that will appear on your November ballot? Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune editor-in-chief Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hello.
And we've got also news columnist Robert Gerke. Hello and welcome, Robert.
Hi, good morning.
And on the phone from the nation's capital, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. And Tommy, very glad you're with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the stories we are covering today, call us at 801-355-8255 or post them at sltrib.com. And since this is the story that we'll be tackling first, should Judge Kavanaugh be confirmed or not? Weigh in. Again, 801-355-8255. Thomas Burr, all eyes and ears were on the Senate Judiciary's hearing yesterday where Christine Blasey Ford answered questions of the committee or of their appointed representative about her sexual assault accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And then later we heard from the nominee himself. Washington has appeared partisan and divided for a long time, but yesterday was an exceptionally partisan day in our nation's capital. Before we get to the responses of Senators Hatch and Lee on the testimony from yesterday, can you just remind us what this hearing was trying to accomplish, Tommy?
Sure, and let me just say, I've covered Washington for more than 13 years now, and I think that's the most contentious hearing I've ever seen. And I've heard from more veteran reporters who have never seen anything like that. It was quite a show. So let's go back to, Anthony Kennedy decides to retire from the Supreme Court. President Trump decides who he's going to pick, and that is Brett Kavanaugh as a circuit court judge here in D.C. And we go through the, normal routine of the hearings. And right after the hearings, we hear about this letter to Senator Feinstein of California from a constituent saying that she had an incident with Judge Kavanaugh, where he apparently, while they were both teenagers in high school, pinned her down in a bedroom of during a house party, groped her, tried to remove her clothes, covered her mouth when she tried to scream, and she said she was able to escape. So this all comes out. They reopen the hearings to hear from her. A reluctant witness in some ways. She said she was terrified. Was the first thing she told the committee, and she spoke very emotionally about this experience that happened, some 30 years ago. Interesting detail, even going down to the point of what she remembers most was the laughter that they were laughing about, her situation. And then we get Judge Kavanaugh, who comes up and in a very angry, fierce denial, yelling back at senators on us. At one point, Senator Klobuchar asked him if he ever, drank too much and blacked out, and he turned back and he said, "Have you?"
Right.
Which is kind of a stunning move from anyone who's essentially in a job interview trying to win votes.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that, to the partisan nature of the vote. And actually, Tommy, can you tell us if there is any latest news? The Senate Judiciary Committee was scheduled to hold a vote this morning to advance Kavanaugh's nomination. It would be a signal to the full Senate. Has that vote happened yet? Do we know?
It'll be happening at 1:30. 11:30 your time.
Okay.
And right now the Judiciary Committee is meeting. They're all talking. I've got CNN on mute at the moment watching the hearing. It's pretty much a done deal though. Senator Flake was the one we were all looking to see what he would do. He's a Republican from Arizona, who is retiring at the end of the year. He's been a vocal critic of President Trump, but he has signaled that he will support Kavanaugh, which with the 11-10 breakdown on the Judiciary Committee means they have the votes to push the nominee out to the Senate floor. We'll probably see a Senate vote Monday or Tuesday. The Supreme Court is back in session on Monday, and he could be sitting there in a black robe on Tuesday if things work out.
Mm. Jennifer Napier Pierce, I'm going to return to Tommy for news on Utah senators in a minute, but I'd like to hear from you first. The central question in the testimony from yesterday was essentially, you know, who do you believe? And that may have been dependent, at least for committee members, on where a person stands politically, where they stand politically or not. I don't know. Can I ask for your overall reaction to yesterday's proceedings on the hearing itself?
Yeah. So for me, that was the second question, who I believed, because the way that this was set up was just inherently not going to find the truth. You know, that the structure that they put up was not aimed at the truth. My question was, can this man serve on the highest court in the land? And from his vitriol, from his partisanship, from his overall demeanor, I would say no. I mean, whether or not he is a sexual predator, I would say this man is not fit to sit on the highest court. He is clearly partisan. He is clearly angry and has an agenda. He's been a partisan hack for, the Bush administration. I think that he showed his true colors yesterday, and I would urge our delegation to really speak out against this confirmation.
Part of this also, I'm going to go back to Tommy now. Tommy, was that there was the Democrats want to see an FBI investigation. Jennifer's talking about getting how this hearing wasn't set up to get to the truth. But Tommy, you've pointed out in your reporting that the Democrats, and as you pointed out just a minute ago, I mean, the Democrats, the Republicans don't want to delay a vote on this and will likely be voting to advance his nomination, as you said, at 1 p.m.
No, and it's not even just the Democrats, too. If I could point out, the president of the American Bar Association sent in a letter to the Senate last night that they should delay the vote and have an FBI investigation. I mean, this is the ABA, which was yesterday Republicans were calling the gold standard of vetting judicial nominees, is saying they should wait. Chairman Grassley of Iowa says he's not going to wait, that he gets to decide and the committee gets to decide and they're going to move forward. I'm sorry, I interrupted your question, actually.
Well, the question that I want to get down to is how Utah's senators, both of whom are on this the Senate Judiciary Committee, how they reacted to this. Both of them, I think, are very much in Kavanaugh's corner. Is that correct to say, Tommy?
Yeah, and we've heard a lot from Senator Hatch, who yesterday was very much defending Kavanaugh, saying he's not a monster. That while Dr. Ford was a well articulate a witness, at one point he called her attractive. We can talk about that one more.
Right.
But he very much said this is a guy who has proved himself in his life to be a person of good reputation and should go forward. Senator Lee, who had been a little more silent actually since the allegations came forward, we were kind of wondering what he was thinking, said in a statement last night that he will vote for Kavanaugh because while he thinks something may have happened to Dr. Ford, he doesn't think it was Kavanaugh who did it, buying into the doppelganger alternative fact, I guess you want to call it that, of people saying, well, it was probably a classmate of his. It probably wasn't him.
Mm. Robert Gerke,
if I could jump in. I mean, of course, Senator Lee is going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh, and of course, Senator Hatch was going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh, and they were going to do it today, no matter what they heard yesterday. They were supporters of his. They were committed to getting him on the court, no matter what, no matter what it took, no matter what came out from the day he was nominated. And so I think the hearing was a charade. It there was no way that it was going to change anybody's mind. Tommy mentioned Jeff Flake that maybe was on the fence. There was talk about, we're watching Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski. Collins had already pretty much said she was going to vote for him. So the hearing was a sham. And then you don't even have, you know, the FBI investigation is one thing, and I think that's what they should do, frankly, but they didn't even bring in witnesses to the committee. When Anita Hill, who was in town last week, when she testified before the committee, they had 22 witnesses. The hearings went for days. They wouldn't bring any corroborating witnesses or witnesses to corroborate Brett Kavanaugh's story. And I think one of the striking moments from the hearing yesterday was when Dick Durbin challenged Brett Kavanaugh to say, I want an FBI investigation to clear my name. We need to investigate this to clear my name. And he wouldn't do it. They don't care about finding out what happened or what didn't happen. And we may never know because this is 35 years ago. Right. But if they're not going to, if they're not even going to pretend to try, because it's just about getting him on the court and getting that balance of the court tilted.
We're also leaving aside other allegations against Kavanaugh that have emerged. A woman who he attended Yale with, another woman from his high school days. The testimony yesterday's, you know, hearing was specific to Blasey Ford's allegations, and so that's what this was focused on. Tommy, Senator Lindsey Graham called the hearings an unethical sham and potentially the most despicable thing that he's seen in his time in politics. And I think that at the core of this is, is it that Republicans believe that this is all stage work by Democrats, a fabrication even, while Democrats are saying, hey, we believe the women coming forward with their stories about Kavanaugh? Is that the divide in the reality here?
Yeah, I think you've nailed it pretty much. I mean, I was tweeting yesterday about, you know, this was like the episode of who can be the angriest white guy at that hearing yesterday. It was fascinating to see Lindsey Graham get so animated about this. And you know, Graham had before been somewhat of a critic of President Trump, but in this case, he's very much in his corner. The Republicans believe that they got sabotaged, that after all, you know, the hearings and all the reviewing documents, this comes out and kind of blindsides them. And they believe it was just an effort to stop Kavanaugh from getting on the court. And let's not forget the idea that if Kavanaugh is confirmed, as it looks like he's likely to be, it will change the court for a generation.
Right.
This will make the court, you know, to lean more to the right. And that's why, you know, Democrats are putting up a fight, but they're also saying, it's about time we start listening to people. Anita Hill was 27 years ago, and we haven't learned anything.
I mean, Democrats, as you say, they do want to delay this confirmation until after the election for that exact reason. And that's something that happened to them with Merrick Garland. But the difference between wanting that and the idea that, you know, Christine Blasey Ford is part of their plot, there's a kind of a big gap there. Robert Gerke?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a false dichotomy. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It doesn't have to be after the election if we're going to do an investigation, because frankly, I mean, it doesn't take that long to do the investigation. And you know, you're right, from the Republican standpoint. As Tommy mentioned, they see this as a setup. They see this as trying to delay until after the election so they can, you know, get their own judge on the court or get a different judge on the court. They see this as fabricated charges. And so, you know, and if you're coming at it from that point, as Brett Kavanaugh was yesterday, I think it's understandable why he is angry, because I think you would be angry, because it's very difficult to disprove an allegation that was made 35 years ago. At the same time, I think If you watched Dr. Ford's testimony yesterday, it was incredibly compelling. It was devastating, and I think that to just hear that and then pretend it never happened, or ignore it, or not ask the next question is irresponsible. But again, it's also politics.
I think the thing that's still hanging over all this too is Merrick Garland. I think Democrats are still, you know, very much upset that the Senate-led Republican-led Senate didn't let Merrick Garland up for a vote for almost a year, and then expired when President Trump, you know, took office. That's part of it, but I think there really is, you know, the Me Too movement has moved this to a situation where people say, let's start believing the victims here.
I don't know if this is a question for you, Tommy, or for Robert, or for Jennifer, but that division on who to believe, is that the divided reality for the American left and the American right as well, not just for the elected officials, but for the people of this country, people who are living, you know, under two separate understandings of what is true? Who wants to take a crack at that one?
I think there was a New York Times column on that very thing, that these two individuals really embody the partisan divide that we see today. We've got, on the one hand, an intellectual who's trying to be measured, trying to be cordial, trying to play by the rules. We have a Republican who's very angry. He's understandably angry, but sort of embodies that part of the GOP right now that is so fed up with everything, with systems, with people, and, you know, to hell with it.
Yeah. One part of this that you know, that's plausible is that you have two people who firmly believe the stories that they're telling, and then you have the potential to just have, as Robert Kirky's pointing out, this just being sort of, I don't know, swept under the rug or left to the wayside, because why get to the bottom of it when politics is involved?
Well, and that's exactly what Anita Hill said on Wednesday when she spoke right here, is that they set it up intentionally to be a he said, she said, and not look further and not try to find the truth. And that's exactly what we saw transpire. You know, there are statements from the other people who were supposedly at the house that night that say they don't recall it. They didn't interview them. An interview is different than a statement, and that's, I think, a crucial difference in this. But yeah, I mean, I think it's it does sort of reflect the divide, and it reflects a deepening divide, I think, in the Senate and among us, among population generally.
Hmm. We have a caller who's got a comment on this very topic that we are discussing right now. It is Rob Latham from St. George, and Rob, you've got a comment about partisanship. Tell us about that. And welcome, by the way.
Well, sure. Good morning. And just by way of background, I was actually on Senator Hatch's Judiciary Committee staff when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was considered for the Supreme Court. So I was behind the scenes during that process. And I've watched, you know, confirmation hearings as a lawyer since then. And, you know, I was a Federal Society chapter head at the U of U College of Law and the Salt Lake City Lawyers chapter. So that's, you know, I'm a libertarian, not a conservative. And I'm agnostic on kind of this incident as to what happened there. But as a lawyer, when I heard Judge Kavanaugh make the partisan comments he did yesterday, that really gave me pause. And I thought, you know, if I ever have the opportunity to represent someone who identifies as a Democrat or someone who is with an organization that is identified with the, quote, left, as he used that term, I am concerned that I would not have an impartial judge, an impartial fair hearing from Judge Kavanaugh. And that's, I think, different than what Justice Thomas did. I thought Justice Thomas, when he responded, had appropriate righteous indignation, but he didn't take it to the partisan level that Judge Kavanaugh did. And that's really disappointing and concerning to me.
I totally agree. When Kavanaugh brought up the Clintons, I mean, really? that's what this is about? You know, and when he consistently would interrupt Senator Feinstein, just throw out motivations that, you know, and theories that he had, I thought, this guy, can he separate himself from his deep-seated partisanship? And I don't think he can.
And again, this is leaving aside all of the, you know,
exactly,
the questions itself,
exactly,
of the hearing itself, but this is him showing himself to have these opinions about the American left. Rob, thank you very much for your call. We're going to have to take a break here in just a moment, but really appreciate your joining us. Robert Kirky.
Roger, if I could jump in real fast, I just want to add one more comment to that. You know, I was just talking to a friend of mine in D.C. who's a lawyer, and, you know, she's mentioning, like, okay, take all this aside. Is he really the most qualified person to be one of the top nine jurists in the country, period?
I'll just point out a little historical context. Up through the 60s and I think into the 70s, we didn't even have recorded votes on these justices. They were done unanimously by voice vote. And then in the 70s, 80s, and now, you know, we see how contentious it is today. I think it shows how far we've come in the Senate.
Yeah. You know what? Actually, before we head to a break, Jennifer, just as we watched this hearing, looming large was the fact that we live in the Me Too era, where so many women especially, are coming forward with their stories of sexual harassment and assault, and with an urgency that they be believed. But then there's that divided reality. I guess your general comments on the power of the movement or of this moment in time and how that played into these hearings.
I thought it was remarkable. I mean, yeah, I was around in 1991, but I was not politically engaged to the extent that I am now. I rewatched.
Like 8 years old then, right?
I know. I'm not going there. I had the great privilege to meet Anita Hill this week. I rewatched her documentary in preparation for it. She was I don't know. She was just a rock when she was doing her testimony. Christine Blasey Ford is the only other person. There have only been two people in that seat who have been coming forward with stories of sexual harassment and abuse, alleged abuse. And I thought to many women, she was very inspiring. To many women, it was a trigger. We actually have a story on that in this morning's paper about how just hearing her describe the assault that she experienced really unnerved a lot of women. And so we are seeing a response in the community. Crisis centers are seeing higher rates of reports, and I think that's all a good thing. But it has shaken up people in a way that I think even Harvey Weinstein's case, you know, that seemed a little bit, I don't know, far removed. We didn't hear under oath the testimony of a woman who has been assaulted and a very highly educated woman who's a psychologist and understands the brain chemistry and everything else. I mean, I just thought it was such, as Robert said, such compelling testimony.
An expert and a witness, as some people have said. I want to stick with a related story or an extension of this story when we come back from a break, and that is the emergence of a new hashtag relating to sexual assault reporting. But we first do need to take a quick pause. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cache Valley ENT and the Allergy Clinic, with providers Drs. Wood, Benyon, and Blotter, and PA Lindsay Humes, practicing ear, nose, and throat medicine, allergy services, and facial, plastic, and reconstructive surgery. 753-7880. And Science Unwrapped in USU's College of Science. Tonight at 7 in the Eccles Science Learning Center, Powers of 10 with USU mathematician Louis Gordillo. Information at usu.edu/unwrapped.
This week on Undisciplined, we're talking about measuring wildlife, but we're going to be joined by two scientists who go about it at two very different scales. We'll ask Emily Sadler to explain her work measuring insect stingers, and then David Stoner will join us to talk about using satellites to count mountain lions and mule deer, the entomologist and the landscape ecologist. That's Undisciplined, Friday at 2.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, columnist Robert Gerke, and Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Jennifer, before we left, actually when we left off for the break, we were talking about the Senate committee testimony and the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. An offshoot from the Kavanaugh confirmation process was the emergence of a new hashtag and a different story being told by survivors of sexual assault. The Tribune's Taylor Stevens wrote about the hashtag "Why I Didn't Report" and some Utahns who used it to tell their stories. Where did this come from, and why was it happening now, Jennifer?
Well, I think, Christine Blasey Ford, wow, how many years has it been since this alleged assault? Why did it take so long? And I think it made a lot of women and men who have been abused sort of reflect on what was going on in their lives and why they haven't spoken up, why they didn't report to police, why they didn't go to a therapist, why they didn't even tell their significant other. And so this hashtag started to gain some ground, especially with some local politicians. We were in an editorial meeting with a candidate, Shireen Gurbani, and she talked about why she didn't report. She put it out on Twitter and said this horrible thing happened to her when she was 8.
Right.
And so when she saw the hashtag, she started clicking through all of the different incidents throughout her life where she felt abused, harassed, you know, and her first one was at 8 in a swimming pool. I mean, that is really awful. And I think she felt like by speaking out, it would help other people feel like they were not alone, you know?
In not having reported.
And
this is the hashtag. The article that Taylor Stevens wrote quotes BYU sexual assault researcher Julie Valentine, who says that this part of the discussion is long overdue. Well, I mean, she says that, I guess, because of the fact that not reporting is actually part of what happens when you are assaulted.
I guess when you have a traumatic experience like that, it takes a long time to process, and your brain doesn't make the connections that it does when you're experiencing a non-traumatic experience. The science is still coming out on that. The research is not as well known as a lot of people would like it to be. Fortunately, people are talking about it now.
Also, you know, you mentioned Shireen Ghorbani, who's a candidate for 2nd Congressional District. Also, Jackie Biskupski, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, talked to the Tribune about why she decided to use the hashtag as well, just for the same reasons, I guess, to bring the story forward.
Yeah, again, I mean, it's just something that she didn't feel like she would ever be believed. She was in college. She admits that she was drunk. Some guy assaulted her in her room. And she just didn't talk about it because he was part of the friend group, and he also... He also said that she agreed and she doubted herself. And I mean, it's pretty awful to be raped and not feel like you can be safe, that you can be believed. So again, it's pretty remarkable that these strong women are now speaking out.
A 20-year-old University of Utah student also spoke to the Tribune about her own Why I Didn't Report story. And something that she said really resonated. It was about how she felt she'd be viewed by her parents, that they might be hurt or confused or unable to process it. Self-protection, I guess, but also protection of the people you love.
Hey, that came out in the testimony yesterday with Christine Blasey Ford. She said that's part of why she held back. She was 15. She was in a house with no adults, drinking beer with boys. You know, just the thought of disclosing that to her parents was terrifying. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why people don't come out and talk about this.
Robert Gerke, the Why I Didn't Report hashtag, another reminder of how many people have been, you know, sexually assaulted.
Well, I hope if anything good comes out of this whole ordeal, it's that there's a broader dialogue about the resources that are available, that there's not a stigma there, that the more people, and we saw this with Me Too as well, the more people who tell their stories, the more people who aren't telling their stories realize that everybody else is going through the same things that they are, and that there are people there that are willing to listen. And so, I mean, I hope I get the statistic right. I think almost 2/3 of assaults are never reported. And so there are a lot of people living with this day to day in silence. And I think the more we talk about it, the more that we recognize it, the more we embrace it, the more we create a safe space and have resources available to help these people, the better.
Can I ask a question about that? This is the fear I have in some form. Will there be a chilling effect? Kavanaugh gets confirmed even after this woman goes through this unbearable hearing and being questioned on, live on TV, 30 million people watching. Do people say, well, maybe I shouldn't come forward because look what happened to her?
Right. The part of the Me Too movement, the message is believe people when they tell you this. But that we live in this period where everything's viewed through a political lens really complicates the situation. Who wants to tackle Tommy's question? Anybody?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's not encouraging, especially for young people out there who may have experienced something, to see the grilling that goes through, the sort of personal attacks, hearing about death threats. I mean, that's not anything to trifle with. And you can easily make the connection that if I come forward, geez, that can happen to me.
I get that point. I hope that people recognize in a social movement like this that it's more about coming out in your small group in a safe space, not coming out necessarily to these old white men in the Republican Senate Judiciary Committee. That's a different ballgame. But I think there could be concern there. I think the Senate, as is usually the case, is probably the last institution in the country to, come to grips with the evolution that we're going through.
Well, Tommy, and you talk about that chilling effect. Tribune reporter Erin Alberti was in a Facebook post, was saying that she had a story she was working on sexual assault where the woman wanted to be identified and named, and then she watched some of this Kavanaugh hearing and said, "I don't want any part of this. Please don't report my name." And so there's chilling effect in effect right there.
Yeah, that's almost what I was referring to. It's scary.
Yeah. I want to turn to one more story related to what we have been discussing on the show so far today, and it's something that we've already mentioned. It's that with these hearings, history was repeating itself. In 1991, Anita Hill made accusations of sexual harassment against Clarence Thomas, and hearings were held. And Anita Hill, I guess by complete chance, was in Utah on the eve of yesterday's hearings. Jennifer Napier Pierce, why was Anita Hill here in Utah?
The Tanner Humanities Center had invited her. Their Humanities Center with the University of Utah. They invited her months ago, and just by fate, she happened to be here on the eve of something really historic. I just as an aside, the Tanner Humanities Center also invited John Brennan, former CIA director, at a very fortuitous time. So whoever's doing the programming up there, they must like have some bead on controversy. It was a remarkable event. Hundreds and hundreds of people lined the sidewalks to get in and just see a glimpse of her. She was really interesting. She's warm. She's wise. She also was very methodical about the way she thought about her personal experience within this larger historical context. And so she was walking through landmark cases at the Supreme Court that dealt with sexual harassment in the workplace, equality issues. And it was just fascinating for her to be able to detach just a little bit and see her personal experience through that lens. It was really,
at
really
this
interesting.
Pivotal moment, too, mm-hmm. in American history. I don't want to go too far into what she said, because actually coming up at 10 a.m. on KCPW Presents, we're going to air Professor Hill's lecture in its entirety, so you can tune in for that.
I think this is one of the few places that's getting a recording, so that's amazing.
Yeah, it's a single airing. There won't be a podcast or a rebroadcast, so check it out. But you mentioned generally, Jennifer, what Anita Hill says but how did she relate that to what's happening right now in the U.S. Senate, about how far the country has come or hasn't come since her testimony back in 1991?
Well, again, we talked a little bit about this. Are we seeking the truth? Are we really wanting to know what happened to Dr. Ford and what happened with Brett Kavanaugh? And the answer, frankly, is no. I mean, people during the Q&A session were asking her to relate her experience to the current set of events. And again, she's super wise and just wouldn't go there. She knew that there's no equivalent kind of experience to anyone's sexual harassment or abuse. On the other hand, she said the process is pretty much the same, that, you know, the optics were a little bit different because there was a female prosecutor, but the makeup of that committee has not changed all that much.
All right. Thomas Byrd, any comments on that? I mean, it did feel, to quote Yogi Berra, like deja vu all over again.
One thing I've learned about Washington is it's all pretty much theater. Everyone yesterday was playing to their bases. They were playing the roles that we expect them to play, like they were cast by somebody in Hollywood in some form. This is just how the system works sometimes, and the actual solution, if you're happy with it or not happy with it, is the ballot box.
Robert Gerke, 27 years since the Clarence Thomas hearings. How far has the country come when it comes to equality or to shifting the culture?
That's a really interesting question. I 27 years ago, I had just started at the University of Utah, and I remember watching the Anita Hill hearings like every hour I could, in the Union Building, and there were arguments because, either people didn't see eye to eye or were pro Thomas, pro Hill. It was a very divisive time that I think we're seeing again now. So in that sense, history has repeated itself. I think culturally and socially, I think there has been progress. Again, as we talked about, the partisan divide in the Senate means that they're not looking for the truth. But I don't think that's reflective of our society, generally speaking. I think that what Anita Hill started was a discussion about some of these issues that we've seen play out for the last quarter century. And we're seeing play out again now, but it's in a very different context now than it was then. And so I think we have seen some progress, in that regard. I think, unfortunately, it's not reflected necessarily in our politics and our political institutions the way it should be. But I do think we're in a different place, and we're going to be moving into a different place, you know, in the next 27 years. But we'll probably have some of these things repeat themselves again. You know, I've got a 17-year-old daughter, and I think that the situation that she's in now is very different than a situation that Anita Hill might have been in when she was a young woman coming up. Excuse me, clerking at the EEOC under Clarence Thomas. And so I hope that's the case. And I hope that it's a different circumstance than it was when Christine Blasey Ford was a young high schooler. And you know, and I hope there's a more of a safety net there, more of a discussion, more less of a stigma than there was then. And I think there is.
Jennifer, both Hill and Blasey Ford pointed to this sense of civic duty for bringing their stories to light, that they wanted, they're concerned with the integrity of the court. I mean, there's another parallel between those two stories, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Highly educated women, super credible, I would say. I think that what they presented was very believable. I thought it was pretty interesting. Anita Hill, during her comments, talked about how Senator Hatch, who was on the Judiciary Committee back in her day, held up a copy of The Exorcist. I mean, really making some connections about her being crazy, possessed, whatever. I think at least we didn't see that yesterday.
one thing that didn't
is that
happen.
A bright spot? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the fact that they brought in Rachel Mitchell, I think was her name, from Arizona to ask the questions is a sign that they're at least aware of the optics now, yeah. if not the message.
Potential political blowback. We're going to take another quick break on the show here, and when we come back, we'll turn to entirely different stories altogether: a change in venue for National Monuments lawsuit and the secretive maneuvering to craft medical marijuana legislation. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Rihanna Gale, science reporter for Utah Public Radio. Part of my job here at UPR is to bring you fun and engaging stories from the science world. If you've got a question, we'd love to answer it. Please visit our website at upr.org or call us at 1-800-826-1495. You can also share ideas with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just be sure to include the hashtag IAMUPR. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. And I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Robert Gerke, and Thomas Burr. This is our Friday morning news roundup. And you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Thomas Burr, let's bring you back into the conversation with another story altogether. It's that the cases challenging President Donald Trump's downsizing of Utah National Monuments, those court cases are going to stay in the D.C. courts. Tell us why and why that matters.
And actually, this is a big deal. It got overshadowed, I think, this week by a lot of other news. But so we all recall President Trump shrank Bears Ears and Grant's Staircase, Escalante National Monuments by 2 million acres last December. And the tribes and environmental groups immediately sued, and they sued here in D.C. In federal court. And the government said, you know, that's not fair. We should have these hearings. The cases should be in Utah, which would have been more friendly venue, essentially, for the government's case that the president did the right thing, and a federal judge denied the motion to move is keeping the case here in D.C. And just to our listeners know, the D.C. federal court is where a lot of agency regulations, challenges to agency decisions are heard. So it does make sense in some ways. But the judge also went one step further, siding with environmental groups, that the government now has to tell, the Trump administration has to give 48 hours notice if there's any surface disturbing action or proposal within the original boundaries. So if while the case is being heard, if somebody wants to drill or mine, excavate of any sort, they get a heads up and then they could file for a restraining order.
Who gets the heads up?
All the plaintiffs in the case, so the environmental groups, the tribes, anyone from Sua to the Sierra Club to the Navajo Nation.
Okay, an interesting development there. Maybe I'll turn this over to Robert Gerke for a second to talk about, how important this is to the case. Actually, and Tommy, I want to come back to you to hear about when we might get sort of final decisions on this. But first, Robert, in terms of keeping it in D.C.?
Well, I mean, I think if they had brought it back out to Utah, there's a good bet they would have gotten a hostile judge. Judge Shelby is really the only one who has ruled in favor of environmental causes in the past, and he has recused himself from all of these. So they would have ended up with a Ted Stewart or somebody like that, and that wouldn't have gone well for them. So it was a victory for them to keep it there. It does make some sense to keep it there, though, because as Tommy mentioned, these federal regulatory actions that are taken. I mean, this was an act, they're challenging an act that was done by the president and the Interior Department, and those are both headquartered in D.C. So in that regard, and the Justice Department that's representing them is also headquartered in D.C. So in that regard, it does make sense to keep it there. Ultimately, I'm not sure that it matters as much, though, because at the end of the day, well, I guess it does matter in this regard. It is going to, regardless who wins at the district level, it's going to go to an appeal. So it's appealed, I guess, now at the D.C. Court of Appeals rather than the Tenth Circuit, which is probably also more favorable. So and then we'll end up with Justice Kavanaugh and his other eight buddies probably hearing this at the end of the day anyway. So it's got a long road ahead of it, the path of this litigation. But I think that, starting it's good for the environmentalists and it's good for the Dene Bakaya and the Indian Navajo groups and the Native American groups. Sorry, that's what I was trying to say. To have it in D.C. rather than out here in Utah.
Well, in the meantime, we're still sort of in this gray area of not knowing, what is the national monument, what isn't the national monument, because you have, one designation and then the undesignation, redesignation. And the fact that it's tied up in the courts means, planning doesn't go forward, Tommy, in terms of making a management plan for the, the new monuments.
No, and that's why I think the decision this week was pretty big. I mean, this is going to take years. Let's just lay that out.
Yeah.
I mean, it took months for the judge to weigh in on whether they should move the case. There's going to be a motion to dismiss filed by the government soon, and then a response from the plaintiffs. And then if there is a decision, like Gerke said, it's going to be, appealed to the circuit court and then to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And so it's going to take a long time. But what the judge did by saying they have to give notice of any possible, mining claims or any changes to the monument, that lets the environmental groups say, essentially help protect the original boundaries for as long as this case continues.
Got it. To intervene.
Right. Once you get that sort of degradation of the resources, then they can go ask for an injunction to stop it if they need to. And so that is that notification is a big deal.
Okay. We are low on time here on the show, and so I want to turn to just one more story before we head to our final segment, the Underplayed Stories of the Week. And Robert Gerke, it's that the LDS Church, House Speaker Greg Hughes, and proponents of legalizing medical cannabis have been working kind of in secret to draft medical marijuana legislation. At the same time, of course, we have a ballot initiative that is going to appear on our November ballots. So, what is this draft legislation meant to do? Because I know you have a copy of the draft bill.
It's pretty secret, yeah.
A backroom deal? What?
Yeah, I know. The talks are sensitive, and so they've been trying to kind of keep a very low profile. But, the bill that I was able to get a copy of, which several people had denied even existed, it did turn out. The discussions they've been having have just sort of been, the bill was based on those some preliminary discussions. Like the speaker went to the church, went to Utah Medical Association and said, hey, here's what I'd like to do. He had him prepare a bill. This was the starting point for their discussions. And there's some significant changes in there. I mean, they're one of the big problems that the church and the Utah Medical Association had was a grow your own provision, which if there aren't dispensaries licensed within 100 miles, you can grow your own plants if you have a medical marijuana card.
This is under the proposition.
This was under the proposition. Yeah. That's out of the draft bill. It was a non-starter, I think, for several people, both in the legislature and at church headquarters. But they met this week to start going over line by line with this draft bill, which is built mainly on the proposition, you know, on the language from the initiative, but, you know, had some significant differences. And it's evolving. It's a work in progress. What I'm told is that they met again this week, I believe on Wednesday. Maybe it was Thursday. Sorry, to try to go over a new draft and go over new language, and it's evolving. One of the things that it appears that they're focusing on right now is a central pharmacy, which is a filling, sort of a centralized filling station where they would fill the orders, ship them out to either dispensaries or pharmacies or county health departments. They're still working through those details.
Isn't pharmacy sort of an impossibility under federal law? I mean,
well, yeah, that's a big problem. And pharmacy in the draft bill, it's all over. They changed dispensaries to pharmacies throughout the draft bill, and the pharmacy is an issue. If it's just called a pharmacy, but it's not really a licensed pharmacy, like licensed by the DEA or FDA, then I guess you could argue that, but then it's just a dispensary that you're calling a pharmacy.
Right.
If it's actually a pharmacy where a pharmacist works and, you know, white lab coats and, you know, that whole thing, then you're going to run into problem because the DEA licenses and inspects and regulates these. And under federal law, the DEA still considers marijuana to be a Schedule I drug, like heroin. And you can't dispense heroin out of a pharmacy, whether you call it a pharmacy or a dispensary. So that's where they're still trying to work through some of the sticky language, I think.
Is it an effort to, is it an end around? They don't want to see the ballot. I mean, the ballot initiative succeed. We know this about the LDS Church.
Yeah.
Is it that? I mean, what happens if it does pass?
Well,
this
is really interesting because there are some who are arguing that they should try to have a special session, like in October, and cut the legs out from under the ballot initiative. I think that is contingent upon them getting to an agreement, which could be difficult still. And also, you know, if they do that and, you know, get everybody on board, pass this bill, and then the ballot initiative passes anyway, then they've got to come back after and repass the bill that just got, you know, because the initiative would still take, you know, preempt it. If the initiative passes, then chances are they'll come back either possibly in November or December for a special session, but definitely during the regular session and rewrite significant portions of the initiative language and replace that. And politically, I think is what you're going to ask, politically, that is a tough proposition, especially if, you know, it gets 60-65%, which is where it's polling right now. That's a pretty compelling mandate from the public. So one of the things that you're going to have to be careful with is not to drastically scale back the access that the public says they want. If they're tinkering with the, oh, we're giving rulemaking authority to this agency, or we're changing this and, you know, tweaking this, but if they significantly change the patients who will have access after the initiative passes, that's going to be a politically tenuous spot for them. However, as that said, if they're going to be doing it immediately after the entire, you know, legislature has just been reelected, so they're not going to have to be up for reelection for two more years. And turns out the public sometimes has a short memory.
Jennifer, you can't take the politics out of politics, can
right.
you?
Well, I mean, Jennifer, the question that occurs to me is, what does the ballot initiative process mean when the ballot initiative passes and then gets undone or at least tinkered with by the legislature?
Well, I think that's definitely part of the case of the people who support this initiative. They think the voice of the people should mean something, right? You can mess around the edges, but the core is medical marijuana should be available to those who need it in the state of Utah. I think that's their message. They want to send a very strong message to the legislature. Look, there will be consequences if you tinker too much.
Okay. Robert, any final comments on that?
I just think there is a representative from Libertas who's participating in these discussions. And I think right now they're negotiating in large part because they recognize that whether the initiative passes or not, there's going to be substantial revisions to it. And right now they have some leverage with the potential that it could still pass and that they could walk away from the table if they don't like it, if they don't like the what's being proposed as a compromise, and then the legislature can deal with the initiative. So that's where I think that's where the talks are right now.
Libertas being the proponents of medical marijuana.
They're a libertarian think tank who was one of the major proponents of this. What's interesting is that there is not a representative, as I understand it, for patients who's at the table right now.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on it. But right now, we have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight some news that didn't make the cut for today's show, at least, but maybe you should have. Who's ready with an underplayed story? Maybe we'll go to Tommy Burr in Washington to start.
Sure, I'm going to tell my own story, but this is something that briefly happened yesterday, but it was kind of a big deal. In the middle of the contentious hearing, someone in the House of Representatives, using the internet there, went on Wikipedia and edited the profiles of Senators Hatch, Lee, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, posting home addresses, cell phone numbers, home numbers. For a while, Senator Hatch's wife is at home getting crazy calls, and they couldn't figure out why. It's called doxing, and it can be a crime. And the Capitol Police are apparently investigating now.
All right. Doxing of Utah senators is Thomas Burr's pick for underplayed story. Robert Gerke, are you ready?
Yeah, I think we were going to maybe get to this one, but we ran out of time, so I'll use this as my underplayed story. The Inland Port Authority has approved a nearly $2 million budget. They're still taking some heat because the $2 million budget was crafted entirely in these backroom committees. I know, shocking. But we're starting to see some progress, I guess, on this Inland Port Authority board, and they're still fighting this headwind that the public seems to think that they've been operating in secrecy because, well, it turns out they have.
Ongoing public criticism of the Inland Port Board from Robert Gerke. Jennifer Napier Pierce, your pick for underplayed story.
You know, can we just have a little fun this week? Yeah. It's been an exhausting week, I will just say. I want to highlight something from our colleague, Scott Pierce. He wrote a profile on the newest addition to The View. I never get to watch The View, but apparently Abby Huntsman is on there, and how she's able to spar with people who do not see her eye to eye. She's enjoying it. She's a Utah native. And I'm not saying that because the Huntsmans own the Tribune. It's a fun read. She talks about how she learned her debating skills from her father, who's now the ambassador to Russia. So it's just a fun read.
Check it out if you want
something non-political.
something lighter, maybe. I'm going to go, for my part, with the permits to Zion Narrows Trail being discontinued.
Oh, that's a good one.
After a landowner posted these no trespassing signs along a one-mile stretch of the land that they own. A couple of stories on this by Brian Maffley and Aaron Alberti. The property owner, it seems, is trying to get the federal government to make a better offer on the land, and this is a negotiating tactic. It's an interesting read. Check it out and the rest of what we've been discussing at sltrib.com. Jennifer Napier Pierce, Robert Gerke, and Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to the people at Utah Public Radio, and to the show's producer, Emily Means, and of course to our partner in this program, the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this program at kcpw.org or on iTunes or however you get your podcasts. And you can also catch up with KCPW on Facebook at kcpw88.3. As I mentioned earlier, up next on KCPW Presents is the 2018 Tanner Lecture on Human Values given by Anita Hill. 27 years ago, her testimony rocked the confirmation proceedings of Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. It's the only airing of the lecture, and there won't be a podcast version, so stay tuned. Once again, thanks for joining us for Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a wonderful weekend.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Dixie State University Celebrity Concert Series in St. George, featuring the Utah Symphony, Thursday, October 4th. Upcoming shows include BYU Ballroom Dance Company and the Atos Trio. Ticket information at celebrityconcertseries.com.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and UPR.org.